It just seems like common sense. If you have something done and you don't want it, like, you can either change it or get rid of it or something.
A juror from the Stevens trial speaks out. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 11th of November. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, a deadline approaches to file abuse claims with the Fairbanks Catholic Diocese.
We really want anybody who thinks for any reason whatsoever the church has harmed them or owes them money to come on in.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
One of the jurors who deliberated in the trial of Senator Ted Stevens is revealing what went on behind the scenes. Stevens was found guilty last month on 7 counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms about gifts worth more than $250,000. At the time of the verdict, none of the jurors on the Washington, D.C. panel wanted to speak publicly. But as APRN's Libby Casey reports, one is now coming forward and even has a blog about the trial.
Juror number 11 is Colleen Walsh. She's 32 years old and works at a Washington church as a program assistant. For 5 weeks this fall, Walsh made the Stevens trial her priority, catching up on work in the evenings or on weekends and keeping family and friends at bay since she couldn't talk about the case that was taking up all her time. It turns out Walsh was an alternate, but after just 2 days off, she was brought back to the jury because one of the women left town suddenly. Walsh returned to a group that was starting over after a long weekend and recovering from some initial stress and fighting.
When I got into deliberations, they were saying, you know, we had some problems last time, we're going to start over anyways. If we can just make sure we don't argue, we don't use swear words, we don't raise our voices, we act like adults. And I was kind of like, what was going on here last week? Because me and I have just been getting along fine before. But I guess it's different when you're actually like trying to get your points across.
Walsh says they got right down to business and worked hard, focusing mostly on emails to and from Senator Stevens. She says the big question was, if someone gets a gift but didn't ask for it, is it still his gift?
One of the jurors described it as, if you get a sweater for Christmas, you don't like it, it's ugly, you're never going to wear it, but you don't give it back, or you don't return it. It's still yours and it's still your gift.
Walsh says that's how they determined that even though Stevens didn't ask for alleged gifts, they were his, and he should have put them on his financial disclosure forms. She believes Stevens never wanted some of the items, like metal stairs on his Girdwood house and a fish sculpture, which Walsh describes as plain ugly. But she says Stevens' emails to Girdwood neighbor Bob Persons show he knew about renovations to his home, including a deck he never paid for.
I know he said that he wasn't in Alaska all the time to get rid of things, but he still had the house worked on and he had his friend check up on it every day and tell him what was going on and everything. And so he could have been like, wait, no, I didn't want a lower deck. Bob, stop that. You know, I don't know. It just seemed like common sense. If you have something done and you don't want it, like, you can either change it or get rid of it or something. And he never seemed to do that. And he never reported it on any of his federal disclosure forms.
Walsh said Stevens' own testimony didn't help, although it was not a main point of discussion among jurors. At first, she saw Stevens as a grandfatherly type, elderly and simple, wearing a hearing device, but that changed when he took the stand.
When he was sitting there, he always kind of looked like frail, and you want to like hug him or something because he had his little earphones on. But then when he got up on the witness stand, he was like on stage, you know, he was like, ha-ha. Coherent and everything, you know, so he's like a lion again. So it was just kind of, well, we can't believe that you don't remember these things and that you couldn't do something about it when you seem like this very capable man.
Walsh says she's read criticism from Republican Congressman Don Young and others who've said the Washington jury wasn't of Stevens' peers and harshly judged the senator because Congress controls much of what happens in D.C. But she simply responds that the jury was made up of hardworking men and women, some of whom juggled full-time jobs and school. None were political types, and none had an axe to grind with the government. And Walsh says she defies a D.C. stereotype. She's conservative and comes from a small town, which she believes gave her insight into Alaska. During the trial, Stevens said he didn't have contracts or paperwork with the men who renovated his house because that's just not how it's done in Alaska. But Walsh found that hard to believe.
Like when Senator Stevens would say, oh, that's the Alaskan way, you know, like we don't do contracts or something. I'm like, I'm from upstate New York and we're pretty like shake hands type of people. But when it came to actually like work and stuff, you still got the contracts because that's how you got paid, you know.
Senator Stevens says he's innocent and he plans to appeal the case, in part because of prosecutorial misconduct. Since the judge criticized prosecutors out of the jury's earshot, Walsh says she's only finding out now what went on behind the scenes. But she says the back and forth of the lawyers and even evidence that was thrown out during the trial weren't on the minds of jurors. Walsh says it was hard, especially for one juror, number 9, to think about what might happen next to Stevens. Would they be sending an 84-year-old man to prison?
When we were done deliberating, we were just sitting there waiting. She had mentioned that she didn't want him to go to jail because he was an old gentleman. And so we're kind of like, yeah, we understand that point, but it's really not up to us to sentence him. He still didn't fill out the form.
Colleen Walsh has started a blog chronicling her experiences and opinions during the trial. She says it's a fun way to blow off steam after her long silence and a way for her large family and all her friends to find out what's been going on in her life for the last 2 months. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
For a link to the Juror's blog, go to our website at aprn.org. The Fairbanks Roman Catholic Diocese is trying to get out the word about an upcoming legal deadline for people who claim abuse by clergy. The diocese filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy earlier this year under a hail of sexual abuse lawsuits, some dating back decades, primarily in western Alaska villages. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the filing began a process that includes a deadline by which all abuse claims must be received by the court.
The bankruptcy process involves consolidation of church assets for payment to a pool of victims who file claims with the court by December 2nd. With less than a month to go, diocese spokesman Robert Hannon says the church is beginning a final victim outreach effort.
We really want anybody who thinks for any reason whatsoever the church has harmed them or owes them money to come on in, because they really need to do that before December 2nd.
Hannon says the diocese is putting out another round of ads in national and northwestern state newspapers to alert the public about the approaching deadline. He says over 200 people have already filed abuse claims. That includes 130 who sued the diocese prior to the bankruptcy filing. Most of the claimants are represented by Anchorage attorney Ken Rosa. Rosa says he expects additional victims to come forward before the December 2nd deadline.
There are some villages, particularly in Athabascan country and in Yupik country, where we can trace periods of up to 20 years where every single year there was a priest or a brother assigned to that village who's a known molester. You know, when you go essentially for 2.5 generations where every kid in a village is exposed to the potential of being molested by someone who's in a position of authority, you know that there are a lot of victims in those villages.
Rosa says there are many older victims who will likely not come forward and some younger ones who aren't ready to do so yet. He stresses that claims need to be filed with the federal bankruptcy court by the deadline and that claimants do not need an attorney to do so. Rosa says the bankruptcy proceeding is the best way for abuse claimants to be compensated, given the Fairbanks Diocese's limited assets.
From the victims and the client's standpoint, what this does, it gives them the maximum amount of money that can possibly be extracted from the diocese and their insurance companies, and then some sort of a process for a fair distribution. It ultimately will not be a simple division of the money by you take the number of claimants and divide into the money and give everybody an equal share. It won't happen that way.
Rosa says claims will be assessed and victims will be given a share of the settlement proportional to their injuries. Bankruptcy will also allow the Fairbanks diocese to move on without the threat of future abuse lawsuits. The diocese, Hannon says, the church is in the process of cashing out whatever it can in anticipation of a payout to victims.
Any property that isn't like a parish or a school or anything like that, we're in the process of trying to sell, and those monies will go to satisfy, go into that pot of money to for claimants. Other property, in this case, an endowment, is up in the air. We say it's off limits because the people who donated and contributed to that endowment had very specific purposes in mind and legally were obliged to honor those commitments.
Hannon says it's unclear if the bankruptcy judge will order all or some portion of the multi-million dollar endowment to be handed over. He says another issue is how much money insurance companies will pay toward victim compensation.
In our case, roughly half of those who have claimed to have been harmed by the church are outside of an insurance period, so they're not covered by insurance. So that means the diocese has to pick up that portion of it. So that's fairly unprecedented in these kind of cases.
Hannon says one former insurer, CNA, has contested its coverage period, but that the company and the diocese are negotiating some level of payment. If the diocese and a claimant's committee cannot agree on what's in a final settlement package, a judge will sort out which assets will be made available to victims. Rosa says victims could see checks as early as next summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, reviving an idea to honor Alaska veterans.
Those who give the ultimate sacrifice in battle also need a resting place close to their loved ones.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Great weekdays begin with the most up-to-date local news and information on APRN's Alaska Morning News. The Alaska Morning News, the news you wake up to. Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 25 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8439.
The Alaska Energy Authority is in the final weeks of preparing its short and long-term plans to help cut back on the use of non-renewable energy in the state. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports that the first and perhaps the most difficult step is determining what fuels Alaskans are currently using.
Without knowing what fuels are used in communities throughout the state, it would be difficult to determine whether any renewable or alternative energy project would be efficient and economically valid. And in establishing the data for the Alaska Energy Authority, Nick Shimoniak of the Institute for Social and Economic Research says there's no typical Alaska community.
There are too many variables that significantly impact fuel use. Each community is different. Each has one or two different things or a couple different things that really drive fuel use. So if we really want to accurately model everything that's driving fuel use, we'll probably end up with almost as many variables as we do communities. And the community data, a lot of the community data we use came from the 2000 census, which is already 10 years out of date.
Shimoniak and ISER's interim director, Steve Colt, were bringing the legislature's Joint Task Force on Renewable Energy up to date on how the Energy Authority will evaluate renewable energy projects. Some variables arise in trying to determine what fuels are used for heating homes, what fuels for transportation. There's no standard on the size or efficiency of homes, or whether there's a related fuel use for a job. He said researchers came up with a rule of thumb that evaluators can use for a general, high-level view.
This actually ended up being a pretty decent fit, and what we found was that there is 737 gallons of diesel fuel use for every household in the community and an additional 548 for every job in the community. And what that showed us is that each house burns about 750 gallons of fuel a year. And then there's lots of fuel associated, a little over 500 gallons associated with each employment.
A rule of thumb is far from a scientific method, however, and legislators wanted to know if the Energy Authority is up to deciding where to invest the money that's been appropriated for the program. Director Steve Hugginson said what they have gets them close enough to decide where more detailed evaluation is necessary. Mat-Su Republican Senator Charlie Huggins said it's better to get the experts working on projects than to wait for more input.
I will go on record as saying that this is not something we can hesitate on because of the criticality, so we move on with the data we have. However, that we also had the strategy at a point sooner than later that we sort of confirm the data we have so it's within the shot group that we think work for us.
Huggins's final plan is expected the first of next month. The task force initial project on renewable energy is due March 1st of next year. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The state's oil and gas division is working on updating a best interest finding that would outline a new area-wide oil and gas lease sale. Public comments are being taken until December 1st. The sale covers northern Cook Inlet shoreline from the city of Kenai to the river drainages of the Mat-Su Valley. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
The proposed lease sale area actually was mapped out 10 years ago. This most recent version of the best interest finding updates the original document of January 1999. Bruce Busby is the Division of Oil and Gas Lease Unit Manager.
This area-wide was first proposed back in 1999. All of the acreage proposed here was acreage that has been leased or offered for lease over the last 10 years.
The current best interest finding is valid for any sales through this year. Work is underway on a new document which, if found to be in the best interest of the state, addresses sales of Cook Inlet oil and gas leases from 2009 through 2018 and allows DNR to conduct lease sales in the area every year for the next 10 years without repeating the finding process. In the Matanuska Valley, the proposed lease sale area consists of state-owned uplands south and west of Houston and Wasilla. The lease area extends through the Anchorage Bowl, south through the Kenai Peninsula to Anchor Point on the east side of the inlet. On the west side, it runs from the Beluga River to Harriet Point.
In the northern part of the Cook Inlet, it does cover most of the acreage within the water. And further down south, it includes a three-mile limit.
The area covers more than 4 million acres and contains some 815 tracts of varying size. Some of the tracts have already been sold in previous lease sales, although Busby says industry interest in the area has been slight so far.
Over the last few years, the lease sales have been minimal as far as interest from the industry, but I would also like to say that this has been in place for the last 10 years, and we saw a great deal of interest early on. The leases are issued typically for a 10-year period of time, so some of them have not expired, so there's still kind of ongoing exploration and activity that's occurring.
Previously sold leases that have not been developed revert back to the state after 10 years and can become part of any future area-wide sales. Those who may have winning bids are not insured carte blanche when it comes to development, however.
Any activity that would occur would have to demonstrate compliance with not only the regulatory authorities, but also those mitigation measures. And so it does address water quality, air quality, effects on fish resources.
Busby says over the past 10 years, the area in question has seen a jump in human population. The lease sale area includes 30 communities of different sizes, and new development could impact some tracts. The original best interest finding for the lease area was written long before the recent listing of the Cook Inlet beluga whale population. Busby says the original plan includes mitigation measures incorporating input from the National Marine Fisheries Service regarding beluga habitat.
Listing of the beluga whales, we're not certain exactly how that's going to pan out or how it's going to change those mitigation measures. But certainly those nymphs is undergoing a management plan to identify the areas of critical habitat, and then they will develop a recovery plan also based on that critical habitat.
So far, the division has held 4 public hearings on the area-wide sale, although Busby says they were poorly attended. The division is seeking public comment by email, fax, or by U.S. mail by a December 1st deadline. If the proposed sale is found to be in the best interest of the state, it could go forward by May of next year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The pollock fishery has closed for the year. Altogether, the sector's caught nearly all of the quota. NOAA Fisheries in-season manager Josh Keaton says this indicates good things about the fishery.
We're, within 99% of the quota. In the past couple years, they've tended to leave a little bit more on the table than they did this year.
He says the implementation of Amendment 80 has also benefited the fishery.
With the implementation of Amendment 80, which affected the non-pelagic trawl or non-AFA catcher processors in the Bering Sea, they were able to manage their halibut bycatch, and they are still fishing, which is abnormal for most years.
Salmon bycatch numbers are also down significantly this year. Until October 25th, the most recently available numbers, only about 3,500 Chinook were taken during the bee season and less than 15,000 non-Chinook salmon.
You know, a lot of things could be at play for the salmon. What one case, why they have lower salmon numbers, I don't think we'll ever know.
2009 pollock quota recommendations have not yet been released.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
On this Veterans Day, activists in the interior are renewing a long-term goal to establish their own cemetery. Vietnam vet Raymond Clark has been a leader in that effort. He was a sergeant in the Marine Corps from 1967 to 1969. Currently, there are only two veteran cemeteries in Alaska, in Sitka and Anchorage. Clark says the idea to establish one in Fairbanks has been around for 7 or 8 years.
We had been discussing it as a group of veterans within the interior here for about a year before we finally started actively working, trying to figure out how we went about doing something like this.
Now, why do you think veterans in the interior need a dedicated cemetery? What's the impetus behind that?
Well, as you're well aware, the interior of the veterans cover all of the villages, virtually from Fairbanks north and again south to Denali. We are a long ways from any national veteran cemetery. So for our veterans to be buried, they've got to be buried in either a public cemetery or a private cemetery, as is the case in some of the villages. We were looking for a place that we could have locally, that we could honor our veterans, hallowed ground, so that their families could come visit them on Memorial Day, Veterans Day, special days, that they were close to them always.
What would it take, do you think, to establish this cemetery?
You know, I'm really not sure as far as today's numbers go. David Guttenberg quoted a figure of approximately a little over $2 million in federal grants that would be needed. When we were working on this project, I estimated if we could get the land donated and some in-kind donations for such things as building roads, clearing the ground, we could probably do it for around $500,000. And then, of course, that's not counting the annual maintenance and upkeep of it.
Well, you need certainly would need legislative support through this. Do you think lawmakers could be convinced in this next session?
You know, I think over the last 2 to 3 years, all of the people within the United States have looked more and more toward our veterans, and only because of the current war that we have going on, looking at them and trying to meet the needs of the veterans. And I think they're beginning to realize that those who give the ultimate sacrifice in battle also need a resting place close to their loved ones.
Do you find Alaskans in general are generally supportive of veterans' issues in our state?
I think more so than many other states, and only because of our large population of veterans.
Raymond Clark is a Vietnam veteran who lives in North Pole. Consistent cold weather this fall bodes well for the Yukon Quest Trail. Trail coordinator John Schandelmeyer says ice on the Yukon River is setting up smoother than normal.
The river's froze about as early as it ever has, you know, in the Circle area and between Circle and Eagle, and there's going to be some rough ice, as there always is, but it looks better than it has been in years past.
Current conditions contrast dramatically with the tangle of jumble ice that injured mushers and dogs and broke some sleds during the Alaska portion of last year's race. Quest organizers created the Alaska Trail Coordinator position to try to improve the race route west of the border. The Canadian military employs dozens of soldiers to set up the trail on the Yukon side. Shanemeyer says the Alaska portion is again being set by volunteers, but they're getting more support and an earlier start.
In Eagle, we have fuel and stakes are already there. And then in Central and Circle, I'll be sending snowmobile parts, and those will be going out actually this week, so they have something to work with. And our stakes are ready to go. They're here in town. They're ready to move, and they'll go to Central and Circle this month with the straw. Fuel will be in Central and Circle before the end of the month.
Shadlmeyer says volunteers have already begun to set portions of the race route on rivers and where there are established trails. But he says more snow is needed before any trail work happens in the rougher areas. He says a Quest crew will traverse the entire Alaska side trail in January to ensure that the route is in good shape a month before the race.
We're going to run from Fairbanks to the border and turn around and come back. And we'll do some preliminary staking and, you know, cutting through the ice where we need to. And by that time, I've been pretty well assured by the folks in Eagle and Central and Circle that there'll be trails wherever they can get them. And worst case scenario, we may have to do a little more of the Yukon and maybe part of Birch Creek. But it looks to me like, you know, everybody's pretty excited about the trail this year. So I think we're not going to have too many problems early.
Shandlmeyer says there's always the possibility that weather can foil even the best trail work at the last minute, and that 2 4-person snow machine teams will break out the route for mushers during the race. He says a separate crew will also conduct a thorough sweep of the trail after the teams move through.
Be picking up stakes, cleaning up the trail if necessary, if there's any kind of trash or straw or anything along the trail, booties. We'll be picking up all that stuff. So the trail, hopefully by the time we go through, there'll be very little sign that anyone came through.
Shanemeyer says trail cleanup has become more haphazard in the past, with some more remote sections of the trail never being covered. The Yukon Quest sprint begins February 14th in Whitehorse, Yukon, heading west to Fairbanks. At last check, 30 teams were signed up for the 1,000-mile race. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
Fish and Wildlife could una kilgutigigat.
Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The deadline for applications is January 9th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.